children. We're starting.
That's right.
Showtime. Another Fresh Picked Pod from audio2u.com. Shutters Inc. With Shelton Muller.
You might wish to stay on and listen.
Hi, and welcome to episode 86 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from audio2u.com. With me on the line once again from Melbourne via Skype, after much screaming and shouting and swearing, Shelton Muller, how are you?
Yeah, but let's just clarify. It wasn't screaming and shouting and swearing at me.
No.
Heaven forbid.
No.
That's my wife's job.
Yeah, exactly.
No, we had a little bit of problems getting the technology to work this morning.
A few software issues this morning.
Needed a coffee, I think.
Yeah.
And you've just sent me a picture you've just taken with your new lens, Bruce.
I have, yes. It arrived here by courier at 6 p.m. about two nights ago, and I haven't had a chance to get out and take anything, and I thought this morning, oh my God, I've got to have something to send to Shelton. I can't start recording and say I've got my new lens and haven't shot anything with it. So I got Max out in the backyard and snapped off a couple of frames before I took him to school. So that's the shot which I'll include in this week's post. So
the 135 2.8 that you got. Yes, very nice.
It blew me away just how much I had to power the flash down. Because that's taken from around about 5 or 6 meters away, so 15 to 18 feet.
Yeah,
and I had to power the flash down to a 16th.
You were using it manually, your flash
manually.
You didn't elect to use TTL or thyristor auto,
right?
Okay, no. Interesting.
So manual exposure on the camera as well as manual on the flash.
Right, so, and you went down to a 16th power.
Yeah, and I had to up the shutter speed to a 1/125th, because I took the first couple of shots at a 60th and it blew it right out.
Really?
Yeah.
Also, of course, at that shutter speed, it's a little dangerous because of the magnification of your lens.
Exactly.
So, you could have got a little bit of movement there as well, a bit of movement blur. So, you're probably wise to do that anyway.
Yeah.
But, post it. And I mean, I'm sure you'll be working with it. You've got a wedding coming up too, haven't you?
Yeah.
So you'll be working with it on
and
that.
To follow up on your suggestion, I went to osmodel.com.
Oh, yeah.
And I browsed around and I found, I did a search on models here in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked through the images that the different models had. And I found one particular model, a girl called Carolyn McLeod, mm-hmm. who I personally felt she could do with some better shots in her portfolio.
Yes.
A lot of the girls had shots that were very professional, but Carolyn, I thought, she could use some decent shots.
It's interesting you mention that, Bruce, because I have, looked at, for instance, the Osmodel site and selected models, as I've said, for work that I've needed done.
Yeah.
And it's true that there's a lot of young models who, believe that they're pretty and therefore they can, they can do some modeling, etc. But what they haven't done is respected the photographic process. They've had a few webcam pictures taken. They've taken a couple of scans off pictures they've had to have taken of themselves at parties. They've, had a mate with a camera take their picture, and so their websites look awful and don't do them any justice. Here's an idea. And this is what you'll, be doing, I presume.
Yeah.
Is, if you see a model with this kind of a website, contact her and say, hey, I can help you out with this. I'm a photographer. I need to practice and sharpen my skills. You're a model. You need to sharpen yours. I can, without a doubt, provide you with some better photographs than those you have on your online portfolio. Because honestly, it's true. If you are interested, go to osmodel.com and have a look at some of the awful photographs that these very pretty girls have taken. Some of them just like sit in front of their webcam and go, here, this is me. This should be good enough for you. But it doesn't work that way.
Carolyn's weren't quite that bad, but I felt that a lot of the shots that she had in her portfolio, they were just snapshots.
They're not doing her justice
They weren't, and it was so obvious that she was a pretty girl, and I was like, man, these photos aren't doing you justice.
Oh.
And that was why I contacted her first off, because I felt like she was the one who needed some better quality photos in her portfolio.
And they don't realize that, well, maybe they think photographers are expensive, and, you know, they can be, but there are so many photographers of quite some skill who are happy to work with models. Now, some of them are seasoned professionals who just like to constantly work to keep their portfolios, their personal portfolios updated, and thus assist models in the process. So naturally, models have to be very careful who they, you know, who they'll get to, you know, photograph them. And there are photographers who take advantage of young girls in, you know, certain circumstances. You know, with you know, nudity or lingerie or swimwear, they sort of. But not all photographers are like that. Very few, actually. That, you know, and there are ways of screening. So, you know, look, it's a great thing for all of us. If you've done this, let me know. If the idea interests you and you want to talk more about it, let me know. Yeah. And if you are a model listening to this and you want some help, let us know, because we have available on shuttersinc.com. Hundreds, thousands even of photographers would be willing to help you out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Just thought I'd throw that in.
For sure. So I'll hopefully get together with her in the next week or so and go out and do a shoot and give this 135mm lens a bit of a workout. So
I'm looking at her as we speak.
She's pretty.
And she's a young blonde. Yes.
Very pretty.
Yes. Well, Kathy knows about this, does she?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. I've been very upfront. I said to Kath, because the thing is, Kath is not comfortable in front of the lens.
Right.
You know, because I said to Kath, I said, look, you know, if you were comfortable doing it, I'd go out and do it with you. I said, but yeah, let's be honest. You don't like being in front of the lens. You don't like modeling. So I said, I'm gonna find a model, someone who's prepared to do time for prints, and then I've got a willing subject. You know, who will be quite happy to be in front of the lens, and you know, I can practice my skills. You know, because I've tried it with Kath before, and it's like pulling teeth.
Yeah, and that can look. It is a problem. I have, you know, I've had the same issues with, you know, Kerry. She prefers, like me, to be on, you know, the other side of the camera, and she, you know, she's very good at it, but you know, doesn't. And I, look, neither do I like having my photograph taken. And I'm an incredibly good looking guy, but.
Of course. What? Nothing.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I thought you... Did I... Were you
no,
laughing?
No, matey. I was just choking. That's all.
Oh, okay. Sorry. There was... Got some, you eating breakfast. All right. Okay. And so, you know, and look, she's a, you know, an attractive woman, but yeah, no, prefers being on this side of the camera. So, you know, on the good side of the camera. So, no, it's absolutely right. Now, what we should do, Bruce, is set you a task that on that particular podcast, I do the interview and you tell me how you did with Carolyn McLeod on the shoot. Things that you learned.
For sure.
You know, during the shoot. Now, what lens you used, what lighting you used, you know, did you use an assistant with a reflector? I'm sure there'll be lots of young men who'll be happy to assist. she's a very pretty girl. If you are an Australian photographer, hell, if you're on the internet and you're anywhere, OzModel is a site that Australia has, and I'm sure there are sites all over the world dedicated to helping models be agency-free. OzModel, OzModel, OzModel is a site that I have... sourced models from for different shoots because they are agency free. The problem with sourcing a model is that, especially if you're putting her on a cover of a magazine like mine with a, you know, a high circulation, the agency just sort of, you know, rubs its hands and goes, whoa.
Payday.
Payday. Whereas a model is just interested in being paid for a shoot, and you know, she loves the exposure of a front cover or whatever. In the case of Carolyn, whom you've chosen, she's a lovely looking girl, but yes, she has very few really lovely photographs.
Yeah.
And so often models will be very happy to do TFP, time for prints, or TFCD, time for CD, and it depends on you,
in
Bruce.
Supply her with a CD of the photos.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right, which is probably what I'll do.
It's easier on you and cheaper, and also better for her because she can reproduce the photographs without scanning, and she can put them on the web, or she can make prints from them, or whatever. You know, how you work that is your choice.
Yeah.
But it's a great practice ground for all photographers. You just have to make it very clear, like you did, Bruce, that you know, you're in this position, and you know, let's work to our mutual benefit. I can't promise you David Bailey images, but then, you know, you're not exactly Gisela Bündchen either, so you know, I mean, I wouldn't say that, but you know, and look, the difference between models, and you learn this, is that, you know, it's not just about being pretty or having a lovely figure. It's some of the
knowing,
world's
how to be in front of the camera.
Exactly, exactly. Because I photographed some very, very pretty brides, for instance, beautiful girls who are hopeless in front of the camera. And others, you know, not necessarily as beautiful, but they just shine in front of the camera. They love it, you know?
Yep.
And their photographs look far, far more spectacular because they know, as you say, how to be in front of a camera. Mm. Models need to realize that they need practice. And of course, working on a TFP basis or a TFCD basis is excellent. So I would, if you're a photographer listening to this, and I suppose, well, you wouldn't be a muso listening to this, would you? you wouldn't be an architect listening to this. Or maybe you are, but you're a part-time photographer. I'll shut up now. And you want to do some, you know, work with a model, have a look at some websites, either in your city or in your country, that are dedicated to, you know, modeling, and you should be able to find a model who's willing to spend a few hours with you on a weekend or, you know, something like that, down at a beach or a local park or a location, and you know, practice on, you know, she gets practice working with you and you with her, and it's a really great way to improve your portrait skills, you know, and your modeling skills, your working with people skills. In the case of you, Jamie, now, Jamie is back. Thank you for your email, by the way, Jamie, with your yo, Shelton. We're in the hood.
Yeah, that's it.
Yo, we're in the hood. Sorry, Jamie, I'm just having a bit of fun with you. Now, Jamie's, do you mind, have you got anything to add before I just launch into answering some emails and keep the segue going? No, you're cool?
We're right to roll, yeah.
I just thought I did a beautiful segue there, that's all.
Yes, man.
Because Jamie asks the question about, he has a wedding coming up, and I'll read his question basically, and I hope you don't mind me doing this. He has a wedding coming up, and he says they're great friends, but they're both quite heavy set. My question is, posing wise, what can I do to make the best out of this situation? What lens would you use, views, etc.? I want to make them look good. If nothing else, please share any experiences you may have had like this one. And look, we all have that experience, Jamie. People are. The thing to remember when you're photographing people, and this could be a beautiful young model like Carolyn McLeod, whom you mentioned, Bruce, or it could be just normal, everyday people who are getting married. The thing to remember is, in the case of people who are getting married, essentially, they know who they are. You know, they're the ones who get up out of bed, look at themselves in the mirror. They know who they are and what they look like. As your job as a photographer is twofold. Make them look as good as they can, but remember that they will also spend a fair bit of time on the wedding day doing that. And also that you can use photographic skills to make your wedding photographs good. In other words, it's not just about posing the couple, but it's how you place them in relationship to the light and the context, where you photograph from, what lens you use, and what lighting you use. All those photographic skills are highly important because in the end, people know what they look like. And so they'll be happy if you photograph them, you know, beautifully in a setting that you know, highlights them and the romance of their day and all their ideals and dreams.
If I could be frivolous, I would say, get a mirror and bend it. And shoot all the images in the mirror.
Oh, yeah. I never thought of that. Oh, those bent mirrors. But larger people can be difficult to photograph in romantic settings because you can't actually pose them too closely together without making it look uncomfortable. It's just the nature of the situation because, you know, they are heavy set. The distance between, you know, say, their chin and you know, their front can be more than the average person. And often you want to bring faces nice and close together, and sometimes that is just not as easy to do. So avoid too much tight hugging and you know, perhaps even keep the couple slightly apart and get them to, you know, lean in and kiss and you will have a hard time simply especially with larger women and men. It's just very difficult to get their faces really close together without actually making it look uncomfortable. Don't try too hard, Jamie. They know who they are. But perhaps if you want to, it's sometimes easier to have the man stand behind the woman Because of course, if she's larger set, she's larger breasted, and so it's very difficult for him to come close from the front. So have him behind her and lean in. That's one way I often solve that problem. And because it will reduce the distance between their faces, if you're wanting to get a nice sort of head and shoulders portrait, or, you know, waist high portrait, you know, that would be one way that I would do it. Also, avoid, if you can, photographing too much from below. In fact, if you're doing portraits of the bride at home, get a high viewpoint and get her to lean forward and look up, thus stretching, of course, the chin and the neck, and giving her, you know, a nice round jawline and thinning the face. Things like that will help, but I suppose the only advice that I can give in this short period of time is to use, you know, nice long lenses, which are very flattering, like your new lens, Bruce, your 135, yep. And of course, keep your viewpoint high. You photograph them from below, naturally they will look down, and thus, you know, you'll get maybe the triple chin effect. You don't want that. Often you want to really try and lengthen the neck and lengthen the, you know, the distance from head to shoulders to give that really lovely form and enhance the jawline of both him and her. So try and keep, you know, your perspective and your viewpoint nice and high. And of course, as I suggested, just avoid the posing that doubles the bulk, if you know what I mean, without trying to, you know, sound in any way uncomplimentary. But Jamie, look, they know what they look like. Your job is to act as a photographer, not necessarily, you know, a contriver. So just work the light, work the context, work the you know, depth of field, the composition, all those things that you would normally do, and they will love your photographs, because in the end, you know, he knows he's not Brad Pitt, she knows she's not Heidi Klum. So why do try and make something that isn't? They're a young couple in love, and they want to get married, and they want you to take some nice photographs of the day. If you do that, you'll be a winner. And the rest, they know what the situation is. So I hope that helps, mate. If it doesn't, you can email me, and we'll be right here waiting. But what I would love to do is see your photographs when you're done, and see whether any of the, you know, whether you, what solutions you came up with, and how my suggestions helped. So I'd appreciate that. That would be really terrific. We got, of course, and we should alert everybody to the new Shutters Inc. Flickr group, shouldn't we, Bruce?
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you, Richard. Richard Annibal, who is, of course, the initiator of our crap, great photo tip, crap finish line. thank you. And you did spell mate correctly. That's mate with four A's. Mate, right?
Right.
Richard has done two things. He has set up a Flickr group for Shutters Inc. listeners, and it would be really lovely if we all got involved. So we'll post that link. I think you already have, haven't you, Bruce?
Yep.
On audiotu.com or shuttersincpodcast.com. We'll post that link so that we can show each other what we're doing. It really is a great thing for all of us to work together and keep this going. I think it's fabulous. Thanks for setting that up, Richard. And let's make this work. But he asks, it would be interesting, Shelton, to hear your digital workflow from shoot to print. Or shoot to upload. What are the steps you take, including basic post-processing, that you do on most photos? It's always great to hear how others approach this, and I quite often learn something new, which then I include into my approach. Now, what I'm going to do is put you on hold, Richard, because on the 28th of August, I'm going to go to a new Adobe CS3 workshop that's being held here in Melbourne. I'm going to spend the day learning Adobe CS3, Lightroom and Bridge, the things that I don't know, and it may, of course, add some interesting tips to my own personal workflow. My workflow is extremely simple. Download into a folder and work the pictures I like. You know, my initial steps are always black point and white point and smart sharpening. Those are just things that I basically do. And of course, you know, any corrections that need to be made in terms of color or exposure or whatever, I will do. But I don't have a magic process, but I naturally do want to initiate some things that, you know, will be of greater assistance with the newer products. So, Richard, I'm going to put you on hold, and we're going to come back after, of course, I've been to this digital workflow day, which, of course, is about new Adobe CS3 and its associated products, such as Bridge and Lightroom. Mm. So you can bear with me on that. That would be terrific. But in the meantime, all of us, let's support Richard, let's support Shutters Inc. Go to the link in Flickr and upload some of your photographs that, you know, have been taken as a result of benefiting from this podcast or anything that you may have done. I would really appreciate it. I know we all would if we could make that, you know, work for the benefit of all. I think it would be fabulous, don't you, Bruce?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let's do it. Let's do it. And finally, Ian. His email reads "Dogs and Lenses" because, of course, he's referring to the the cover of Total Image that we have we've got up on audiotou.com. Shelton, no, we have not met. I'm waiting for the Shutters Inc. Melbourne get-together. And, of course, we do have one coming up when Bob comes over. Bob Fisher comes over. We're going to have that lunch together. So, I don't know, maybe if he doesn't mind, we can incorporate you into that meeting, Ian. We'll get a whole group going on. He says, further to the photo of the dog, I take it that it was shot at 17 mil. Yes, you're right. Do you know the aperture? Yes, I think it was 2.8 because it was a very overcast day and I needed to do what I could without getting too much noise in the image. I was particularly impressed with the story. Stormy sky, yet it was a stormy day, and the light on the dog. Wonderful pick. I had been looking at lenses which started this correspondence. One I had been considering was the Tamron 17-50, and after your comments on the last show, I now have one gracing my 30D. It's lovely. Yes, it is. It is a really lovely lens. I'm very impressed with mine. It's my working lens, and it's fabulous. So I'm glad you like it, Ian. And I'll have to let the good people at Tamron know that my recommendations are working, so I can get more free lenses from them. No, I mean.
So am I correct in assuming that your 80 f1.7 is no longer your live-in lens?
It's my live-in lens for that kind of work, but my walk-around lens is my Tamron 17-50. Right. If I'm shooting a wedding, it's 17-50. It's a great focal length for anything you need to just grab or capture.
Yep.
And it's 2.8, and it's very sharp, and it's really quite lovely. So yeah. My 85 1.8 is my live-in lens when I'm doing the kind of work I do a lot of.
Yeah.
But although the other day I did get out my 183.5 and do it, and didn't use my 85 hardly at all. So who knows? What could be happening with that, but I've put a couple of pictures on my blog with the 183.5 that I really like very much.
When you're shooting a wedding, do you shoot with just one body or do you take two bodies with you?
I take two bodies, sometimes three, if Kerry's not using hers. Only because, of course, the benefit of
you
that
can leave different lenses on them.
Well, yes, one can just simply act as an off-the-shoulder lens carrier, So my two basic lenses that I live in, and you might benefit from this too, Jamie, because you've got a wedding coming up, is that I have my Nikon D200 with my 17-50. That's the lens I walk around with. And I have the D100 with my 85 1.8 on it. And so all I have to do is just simply transfer lenses one from the other, which takes just a couple of seconds to do, if indeed I need to, swap one to the other. The D100 is there as a backup should my D200 pack it in or vice versa. And if and my wife's D70, which she's had for a few years now, is my third camera just in case, because that's a lovely camera, the D70. So but I haven't had any issues with either of them yet. I've never had a camera, I only had a camera break down on me once on a wedding, and that was years ago when I was shooting with a Mamiya RB67.
Right.
And the shutter went, and it would only shoot at 1/8 of a second.
Yeah,
and so everything I shot, thankfully, we'd done the ceremony and a lot of the other stuff, and just all of a sudden we were in the last hour of the shoot, and my shutter just went and would only shoot at 1/8 of a second or thereabouts. So everything was, very tripod, very hold still.
Yeah.
I managed to make it work, and that's the thing about it. Often these situations arise, and man, you've got to think on your feet.
Yeah.
And wedding photographers should be highly applauded for that, because they do. They have to think on their feet from go to woe, and still produce pictures. Wedding photography is one of the hardest things to do as a profession. And make and get a reputation for.
Just as a side note, I don't know if you saw it, matey, but I posted those links last week for both Strobist and DIY photography.
Mm-hmm.
And off the page there was a link to a video which I wasn't aware of until one of our listeners wrote to me via email and said, man, how sick was that video? And I was like, what? So I went and found it, and you've got to go and check this out. This guy who's a wedding photographer, and he gets the bridal party to stand around him in a circle,
mm-hmm.
sets his you know, I don't know what camera it was, but it was like a high-end digital SLR, as you would if you're shooting a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Sets it on a 2-second delayed shutter release, presses the button, says to everybody, watch the camera, waits a second, and then hurls the camera 20 feet in the air. Right. And gets this image while the camera is pointed to the ground. I don't know how he times it, but he gets this image of everybody looking up at the camera from 20 feet above and him standing in the middle, and he then photoshops himself out of the middle of the shot.
Oh.
And then catches the camera. And I was like, man, you have got to be nuts.
Perhaps he was a baseball player or a cricket player before he became a photographer, because, man, I ain't throwing my camera 20 feet in the air.
Man, you got to go and watch the video. It was just insane.
I will. That comment was from the email from you, Rob. Rob Iverson.
Oh, was it? Okay,
it was,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says, now for my comment, that link to the flash photography and the one video of the photographer who throws his $5,000 camera into the air taking multiple shots is sick.
Yeah.
I mean, sick in a good way.
Yeah.
I was wondering when you can demonstrate that technique. Rob, never. Tell us how often you use it. Never. I suspect that it is rarely used, yeah, but I thought I would ask, as it may lead to other absolutely crazy techniques that you may have used with surprisingly good results. I love my cameras. They are tools, and I don't pamper them, but I don't know that I'll be throwing mine into the air. I will have a look at the video, though, because I'm sure. Yeah,
I'm not kidding. I'm not exaggerating either when I say 20 feet. Like, he really threw this thing high. It was just crazy.
Well, anyway. I'm going to have a look at that, because it is great. Rob has also got recently a Tamron 17-52.8, so Tamron must love me, but because they are good lenses. But thank you, Rob, also for sending through a pack of suggestions for future podcasts. Very much enjoy it. And we will get back to you on a lot of the things that you've asked in these podcasts. So bear with us. I only have one criticism for you, Rob, and that is that you said you're moving from Phoenix to Boston, hoping to capture the changing colors, but you've said that photography has taken a back seat as a result. Now, tisk, 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 young man. Obviously, you don't carry yourself around a little compact digital that, you can look, photograph the move, What are you doing, Rob? Please. And look, I would be... Now, Rob suggested some time back that he would be able to get a group of people together and sponsor, me coming over to workshop some photography there. And I would be still very happy to do that if indeed that interests not only you, Rob, but anybody who listens to this podcast. Wouldn't be the first time. And I would be more than happy to do that. It would be great to meet all you guys and head out on a shoot together. And we could produce some fabulous stuff. So if that idea still tantalizes you, Rob, I'm with you all the way, mate. Absolutely. Sounds like a whole bunch of fun. If we can afford it, we should bring Bruce along with us.
Absolutely.
Though, don't you think?
Yeah, so I can record it for the podcast.
Absolutely. I think so. Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Now, we said last week that we were going to talk about frames.
Yep.
And perhaps we should do that because we promised everybody. And I think it's an interesting subject because we have talked about positive and negative space on this podcast.
So just to clarify before we get started, you're not talking about the frame you hang on the wall, are you? You're talking about framing through the viewfinder.
The absolutely. How important that border is and what we can do with it and how we should use it, what our perspective on it should be. We talked about positive and negative space a few podcasts ago, but really, essentially, there are three elements to a photograph, and they are positive, negative space, and the frame. Now, we don't often think of the frame as being a compositional tool really, it's just the limit of our photograph. But when you think about that, the limit of your photograph must be a compositional element and can be used to do all sorts of things. But working within your frame is really what photography is all about. As photographers, or as human beings rather, we have very large peripheral, incredible peripheral vision. And our frame of reference is incredible. The thing about photography is that what we're doing basically is putting everything we see into a frame. Essentially, that's photography, taking something and putting it into a frame. So the frame, therefore, is your absolute form of reference, or, no pun intended, frame of reference. And really, it's up to you to choose, as we've often said, what to leave in and what to leave out. And if you think about that, your frame is, you know, very important then, because it does dictate what you leave in and what you leave out, apart from, of course, any depth of field techniques, which would make, you know, distracting elements out of focus. So you choose what that is. So in other words, your frame is your editor. Apart from depth of field, it is the thing that says, or perhaps exposure also, it is the thing that says, I don't want this in the shot. Or I do want it to be implied, but I don't necessarily want it to be included. And so you use your frame as to you know, very powerfully work all of those things. In other words, you can imply in a photograph what is outside the frame. And that's what I mean by that, by implication. If you have someone, what we often have in portraits is something called looking room. In a portrait, you can have a person off to a left or right third looking into the remainder of the frame. And that's called looking room. And one technique that is often expounded is that you should give your portrait subject looking room if you've put them off to the side. In other words, and I'll upload a photo I'm thinking of that I took in China, where I've got a Chinese man sitting and he sort of runs this mechanic shop. And he sits and he's looking into the frame. But I also have images where I've done exactly the opposite. I've put him in that far third, or put the subject in that far third, but have them looking out of the frame. And so by implication, you're saying, there was something I'm not showing you. There's something he was looking at that just adds that little bit of mystery. What is taking his interest that is not in the frame that I can't see? And therein, if you think about your frame, therein is its power. Because it creates this element of interest. What is outside the frame that I didn't include that this fellow is looking at, or that people are wondering about or heading towards, or whatever your photograph may be of? The frame being your limit can create all sorts of interest, even outside itself, by implying from within the frame. So you can use looking room, not licking room, looking room, as a very powerful tool to either bring the eye of the viewer into the frame, or have them constantly battling, you know, or struggling from looking out the frame. And that's a very interesting emotional effect. It really does engage with the viewer. But also the aspect of the frame is very important. Photographers who shoot 35mm or standard, you know, sensor size have an aspect of, say, you know, 4-3, which in terms of 35mm was your 24x36mm frame. You know, an aspect of 4-3, which is sort of retained even now in digital. And we're used to working with that. But of course, people who worked in the darkroom were used to cropping, because they would be able then to change the aspect of their frame to whatever they wanted, and they would consider that while they were shooting. If you think of a panorama photographer, you know, like in Australia, you've got great panorama photographers, Ken Duncan, Dan Paris, Peter Luck, men like him, and of course, you know, I'm sure that those kinds of, those, you know, panorama photographers are all over the world. It's such a fabulous format. Years ago in the movies, you know, when movies went from a sort of shorter format or shorter aspect, like a 4-3, and they went to, what was it called, Panavision?
Right.
They suddenly just increased the whole, you know, vista of what they were able to include. And it was quite an interesting technology that required, you know, three bunches of film stitched together and all sorts of weird and wonderful things. But they did it because they realized that it was a whole new way of framing a movie, framing a subject. When you watch those movies on TV, you know, they've had to bring the format right down to TV format, and you lose so much of what they had intended because they have composed with reference to the aspect of the frame. And, you know, you lose the impact, the effect, and the compositional beauty of what they achieved. So the aspect of your frame is very important. Panorama photographers, like, you know, I know Dan Paris personally, he writes for me. and he sees panorama. Whenever he shoots, you know, he's got a Nikon D200 and he's getting used to that. But his whole way of shooting is panorama. That's the way he sees. And, you know, I find that a very difficult thing to work with because I haven't had that much experience with panoramic view. I have very rarely worked I've only worked with a panorama camera a couple of times commercially. And I don't necessarily see my photographs that way. So that's a learning curve for me. He's on the other learning curve whereby he just almost immediately got into using his Fuji 6x17 panorama. And he finds it very hard to shoot in a shorter aspect, like a 4-3, which most of us are used to. But if you take that now, we have the opportunity digitally, very easily, to crop with a different aspect. We can make our aspect square, rectangular, panoramic. We can do whatever we want now, very easily, by simply loading up your image into Photoshop or PaintShop Pro or whatever image enhancement or editing suite you're using, and cropping so that we can, you know, so that you can do that more effectively. And so therefore, when we're taking our photographs now, if we're digital shooters particularly, think in terms of, well, what will I do with this? What can I do with this in terms of its frame and the aspect? We needn't necessarily think that just because our camera is designed with a particular aspect, which is mostly 4-3, that's the way we have to then compose. That may be the way the image comes out of the camera, but your pre-visualization comes into play and says, well, actually, I didn't want that much sky. Actually, I didn't want that much foreground. What I was really seeing was square. And sometimes you don't even know it until you open up the image and you think there's just something not right about this. And then you realize that it's the aspect. The aspect of the frame is wrong. And I was working on an image last night that I took in Peru, and there was just something wrong with it. And it's an image of a mud brick hut in front of the Andes, an Andean backdrop, and this sort of cloudy sky that emanates from the mountains. It's quite wonderful. And we were walking around this old, you know, scene in Peru a few years ago. And I walked, you know, over to this old building and took this shot thinking, wow, this sky is just amazing. And the Andes and the shed. But when I look at the image, I'm just thinking there's something wrong. It's just not working. And last night I cropped it. I cropped it to a more panoramic format, and I actually got rid of a lot of the sky that I was, you know, concerned about getting rid of, because it was quite a wonderful sky. But the moment that I cropped the sky down, the image started to live. And I changed the aspect of it completely. And that's when the photograph started to work. And so, in terms of composition, let's start to think of our frame as a compositional tool, not only in terms of its aspect, but as an editor, what to leave in and what to leave out. Photos are frames, and the frame is a two-dimensional thing, but it's a very, very important thing. It makes the subject the subject. The other thing that we need to realize about frames is that they are an immediate point of reference. And so working, as we've often said in composition podcasts, that frames within frames are very, very powerful. If your photograph's frame is powerful, think about doubling that and shooting frames within frames. Now, that's a whole other subject completely, but frames are powerful because the whole power behind the photograph is that you've isolated. Our peripheral vision takes in so much, but our emotional vision concentrates on that which is important. We focus on something, we concentrate on something emotionally, and in a human way, we put a frame around it, even though we can never really change the aspect of our eyesight. In an emotional way, we put a frame around the thing we're looking at. If it's the person we're talking to, if it's the item we're picking up, we've put a frame around it. Emotionally, you can't do that photographically in the sense that, you know, because it's not a human experience, but you can do so by using the frame. And the frame, therefore, is that which says, this is what I'm talking about. This is what I want you to see. And where we often fail is exactly in that. Photographers try to incorporate so much when they're standing in a vista and they just take this big vista shot. It doesn't work. Because the human experience is a live emotional experience. The photographic experience is taking something, putting it within a frame, and making it work so that we relate, you know, an image to the viewer to try and create an emotional response Your frame is the powerful means by which you do that. Then, if you add a frame within a frame, you've got it even more powerfully again. We have a tendency to want to frame things that we can't, you know, that we can't see, i.e. painting. You know, humans have been painting for millennia. That's their way of putting a subject within a frame. So your frame is your absolute point of reference to work from the outside in. And using that, thinking of your frame as a compositional tool, is another great way of making sure that your photographs work. So that was basically what I wanted to talk about. It was something that we hadn't highlighted before on the podcast or talked about, something that no one had ever raised, but I'd love your thoughts on it if you're listening, to what you've come up with, what you do in terms of using your frame, and perhaps what, you know, default cropping you might even prefer. For instance, in the, you know, the dim dark ages of film, you could buy, I had a Mamiya RB67, which had a 6x7 centimeter negative, but I also had a back that produced a 6x4.5 negative. And I used to use that on weddings because it gave me, you know, more frames in a 120 roll. But it was a different, was a slightly different aspect. 6x7 was more square, and 6x4.5 was, you know, a little more rectangular. At least so it looked anyway. But Hasselblad had a square format, and it was 6x6 centimeters. You could buy 6x9, and, you know, it all used the 120 roll, but how it framed, you know, a lot of photographers years ago used Hasselblad because they loved the square format. But in speaking to Hasselblad photographers, they often said, well, what I love to do is shoot square and then later crop according to my desire. Every photographer has his or own way of working with a frame and an aspect. I'd love to know what your method is and how you felt about this particular subject, because it's something we haven't dealt with before, but is nonetheless a very powerful tool in our photographs. So get back to me and let me know what you think.
Fantastic. Thank you, mate.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Now, let's also mention before we sign off, yep, that we have the Kangaroo Island tour that I'm organizing, yep, for March next year. If anybody's interested in coming to Kangaroo Island next year and having a whole lot of fun doing some landscape and some local photography there, we're going to have a ball. It's a really interesting island. There's a lot to photograph there, and it'll be a fabulous few days. So the PDF is downloadable with all the information. So if you'd love to come, it won't be a particularly expensive trip, but we'll yield some great photographs and hopefully yield some great new things for you to learn. So let me know if you're interested in coming along. We'll have a ball.
Absolutely.
Thank you all again for your emails and your interaction. And once again, a reminder, let's get behind that Flickr website.
Absolutely.
For us to all upload our photographs and be part of an international community that will save the world.
Yeah, and that link is on the blog. And remember, you can bookmark that at shuttersincpodcast.com. You can email myself at studio@audiotu.com or Shelton@audiotu.com.
That's me.
And we'll talk with you again next week.
Looking forward to it, mate. You take care.
You too, mate. See ya.
Thanks. Bye.
Now, how much of that did you understand?
Audio to You delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable. You be the boss. Hear what you want to hear.
When you want to hear.
Hit us today. And remember, Control-D to bookmark. AudioToYou.com.
It's all over, Marge. It's all over.